You didn't know me back in my time. You don't know the things I've done.
I've heard stories.
It happened in slow motion. The titles didn't come, and then there was a field so green, I thought we were at Hobbiton. I literally wrote in my notes, looks like Hobbiton, it's so green. Hey, what are they building? Who's building it?
What show is this?
And then who do we know that has sandy hair? I had time to think that. Who do we know? Because this was clearly going to be a reveal of a familiar character, the way the camera panned up on the field. Who's working here?
Who do we know? Though, I mean, who would be the most obvious choice? Because when I was watching, the first thing that came to mind was, it's going to be Gendry.
That's what I thought.
Really?
That was exactly what I thought, but he doesn't have sandy hair. As soon as we saw like the little curl in the back of the neck, I was like, this isn't Gendry. Who's it going to be? And I was shocked.
I felt like I knew it was the Hound.
Really? From when?
Yeah.
Okay, at what point between like all of the shots of the field and the men working, like what?
Like
what
before was the episode started, do you guys think the Hound's coming back this episode? I literally said that. At dinner.
Well, we were invited to dinner, first of all.
Sorry, where I spilled all my Game of Thrones spoilers.
To your grandparents?
Mm-hmm. Well, I felt like, I mean, this isn't necessary. With Ian McShane, then we knew that something was going to be going on this episode, right?
Yeah.
And there's been speculation about who he was going to be. And so I just assumed that he was going to have some role with the Hound. And he was phenomenal.
With the Hound, huh?
He all but revealed that in an interview, by the way, for those listen to the show who aren't aware of this fact. He did an interview a couple months ago before the season premiered where he actually pretty much, without saying the exact name of the character, said that he was going to be involved in bringing back a very important individual who was thought to be dead. And so here we have it. I mean, just an amazingly written episode too, from start to finish.
Brian
a lot
Cogman,
of characters came back.
Mad props, sir.
Not just the Hound.
No, you're right. You know, we got a lot of this episode. For me, was own after own after own, and that was something I was I had a little bit of trepidation going in, because this is the shortest episode this season that we'll get.
Eight minutes left.
Yeah, that's what
I
you
want
tweeted.
Those 8 minutes back. I guess
hey,
we'll get them in the finale.
Thrones, you left some minutes out of this episode. Mm-hmm. You're gonna nail a letter to the door of their offices, which you know where they are, right? Aren't they in New York?
Yeah, I can walk by them tomorrow. And
well, there you go, nail it to the door and stuff. But no, I mean this episode for me, this was probably, we say this after every episode, one of us does, don't we? But this is my favorite episode this season.
And you know who else's favorite episode this will be for this season? Zach's.
Who?
Because
his number one,
the Hound, his number one is back.
Zach loves the Hound,
wielding an axe, and who knows what he's going to do with it. And Zach, I think he just was too overcome with emotion and was unable to be here with us. Unfortunately, he will be back on Wednesday's episode. But this was just such an unbelievable return for a character. I felt like this episode was filled with characters returning. We had Bronn, we had Blackfish. I'm probably missing somebody else, but just to see all those familiar faces, I feel like the writing has done a very good job of kind of consolidating different themes into different episodes, and this was an episode really that, when you talk about the title, The Broken Man, it could have been referring to Ian McShane's character. It could have been referring to the Hound. It could have been referring to Theon. It could have been referring, to a number of different characters in this episode. And I just love the fact that they are able to write it in that way.
You know, this episode was bookended by Hound scenes, and there were plenty of them even peppered in between. This was, if we had to pick a character that this episode centered around, even though we got so many scenes from so many different areas, the Hound would be it. And this is something that I'm still, you know, coming to terms with, having just seen the episode and got on a record. The Hound is still alive.
Yeah, and it's implied that he didn't actually die.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
and it's not
is new.
It's not that Ian McShane brought him back knowing the ways of the Red God, the way Beric and Darian and the men, Brotherhood Without Banners, you know, that we're accustomed to seeing. It's just that after all that, after all of his wounds, the Hound just refused to succumb to them, despite how brutal they were.
Fueled by hate.
Fueled by hate. It's according to him.
According
maybe
to him.
It was maybe it was something else, you know, that he's not quite ready to admit yet. Like, I don't know, love.
That is shocking to me, though, Hannah. I'm interested what you think, and Eric, you too, from what we had all anticipated from the books. The Hound, if he was going to be brought back, would be brought back in a similar capacity to Beric Dondarrion. And now it seems like he survived. And, mm-hmm. and that is just mind-blowing, because you think of the characters that have been brought back to life, mentioned Beric, but also Jon Snow earlier this season. It would seem like somebody who's left for dead on the side of the road in this type of environment, in this type of world, is not going to be coming back. You might as well just write them off.
And that was what was so shocking about it for me, because again, off-screen deaths, it's like, oh, they could come back because we didn't see them die.
Stannis.
And even sometimes when we, yeah.
Stannis
even
is still alive.
Stannis is next, guys. but you know, there's also the idea that even if they do die, they can be brought back by magic. But I still just was not expecting the Hound to be back. And now I love it. And I can't figure out what to make of it, because this is like, okay, so this episode, going into it, I thought, you know, there's a very, very good chance that Arya can survive. In fact, I speculated on last week's episodes that Arya was in no danger at all. Like, I didn't believe there was any chance that she could be in danger. And then this episode turns around and had so many surprises. And of course, Arya is in danger and appears to be wounded quite severely. But now I'm thinking, look at what they did in this episode. They brought the Hound back. Like, I still think there's like just so much hope surrounding all the characters that we love surviving now because of this one generous act of returning the Hound to us.
Mm-hmm. I am glad, though, and I know that we'd speculated before that if the Hound came back, like you were saying, Micah, he would come back by Beric Dondarrion, by this magic that we have learned about. And I'm glad that it's been implied that he didn't actually die and that he wasn't. I mean, maybe there was sort of something that helped him live and hang on. But my worry has been that this whole season would be everyone comes back to life. And I don't like
by
that.
By magic.
It almost feels like a cop-out, and I hate saying that, but I didn't want just, like, the Hound, us to find Lady Stoneheart, Jon Snow. Like, I didn't want, like, all these people to be coming back to life so easily. And so I'm glad that it didn't necessarily turn out that way, that we get the Hound without it being another magic thing.
Right.
That he
according to him,
on.
It's just because he's a big fucker and he's tough to kill.
Yeah.
But right. I mean that because the great thing about that too is that Ian McShane's character of the Septon, whom I loved, that was a brilliant performance and so great to see him on TV again. But you know, that character still asserted that there was a reason and a purpose behind the existence, behind the Hound's continued survival, and so even though a god or a mysterious power did not, so far as we know, directly intervene in keeping the Hound alive, there's still this idea of fate and destiny, and that he has tasks to fulfill, or as Lost would say, work to do. And ultimately I see his storyline, because now this is something that we are blessed to speculate about. Where will he go from this village? I think the episode did a great job of kind of
hinting
at. He's going
to create his own list now and go after these people. But
he learned from the best.
The fact that he had the conversation with Ian McShane's character about the gods, that to me was just a clear indication, having come into it anticipating that he was brought back, as we've mentioned now, through some sort of magic. Mm. When Ian McShane's character says, and he lists out all the gods, you know, the seven, the old gods, the Lord of Light.
I don't even know their real names.
Right. They could all be the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Who knows the answer to the question? And so that was an indication to me that this man is no Red Priest. He's no Thoros Amir, who's another character that we learned about is going to be making an appearance this season. So that even further fueled the speculation that perhaps Thoros was going to be bringing back the Hound at some point. And now we're here and the Hound is back. He clearly has an agenda. I wouldn't want to be either of those three men that showed up at the camp.
Or the rest of the Brotherhood.
Are we supposed to believe that that was in fact the Brotherhood?
I think so. Curious. I mean, well, the Hound speculated that it was the Brotherhood. And that was my first guess when I saw them. But I guess we don't really know for sure.
I think it's clear to me that now that the Hound is not back, but still alive and back on the show, he needs to team up with Arya again. They just need to pick up where they left off, traveling the countryside together. The dream team, they're back. You know, Hound Arya, she doesn't have her direwolf, so she's got the Hound instead.
Not yet. I mean, she can find Nymeria when she gets back to Westeros.
She could have two Hounds. That'd be awesome.
True. My question is, what has the Hound been doing? You know, if he wasn't brought back to life, I assume that he, of course, whatever state he was in, needed to be nursed back to health. But why was he staying there for as long as... I mean, I guess we don't know how long he was with them, but what was keeping him in that camp?
I think it was searching for a greater purpose. I think that it was just doing something different than raping, pillaging, and killing. You know, I think it was because this alternative lifestyle was presented to him in a time. Maybe he felt indebted as well as a result of this man nursing him back to health. But, you know, it's kind of... the labor that they were doing there and going and seeing like the bread line, or not even bread line, but like fish and everything that they were eating. It was a self-sustaining community nearly. And they were building that structure, which could have been a windmill. You know, I'm pretty sure it could be identified on a repeat viewing, but who knows what it was really, except that it was good work. You know, these are honest people. And in the Riverlands, where it's clearly, you know, you're not out of danger yet, people. Clearly, double clearly, as a result of the end of this episode. But, you know, I think that's what it was for the Hound, that it was a chance to do an honest day's work. And Ian McShane's character of the Septon says it's never too late to turn back and to do some good. And I think that was entrancing. And the Hound was just toying with, well, maybe that's true.
Second chances. I think that was a theme in part in this episode as well. And I think that he sees it as an opportunity. And he had a bit of a second chance with Arya as well. And I think the relationship that they developed over the course of the time that they spent together changed him. And I think now this situation that he finds himself in, the people that he has lived with for however long a period of time, the man who is responsible for bringing him back to life, have all been killed. And I think that that is going to maybe in part bring back the Hound that we knew early on in this series. I mean, we have not seen him for at least about a season and a half, right? He died at the end of season 4, supposedly. Arya left him on the side of the road before she headed off to Braavos. So it's interesting that she should be on the cusp of coming back to Westeros when he now has reemerged.
That's why it felt like the gears were turning and that this was some grandmaster like plan for it.
I love the
writing,
it.
Yeah,
I mean, but I wonder if Arya would if he has a list. I wonder if Arya's on it, frankly, because it can't have been painless sitting on the side of the road and gradually overexposing himself to death in the sunlight.
Well, you're saying because Arya didn't give him mercy and didn't kill him.
Yeah.
It was, in fact, of course, Brienne who inflicted those wounds upon him.
You know, and something about that, too, is when he was telling the Septon that story as well, and the Septon's like, ah, oh, some big fucker must have killed
he's
you.
He's cutting the wood.
Yeah, and he just says, oh, it was a woman. He's not too angry about it. I mean, he's clearly like, oh, this is embarrassing in a way.
Yeah, but I think he has it out for Arya.
I don't think he even has it out for Brienne. I think he has made some sort of peace. I don't know, this I don't want to say pacifist vibe, but like this man's aura has surrounded everyone there. And granted, there aren't many killers among them from the looks of things. I think probably the Septon himself and the Hound were the only ones who had done the sorts of things that the Septon was talking about in Could Be Called a Sermon. But you know, I think it really has changed the Hound in some profound way that we're yet to see, although I don't think it would mean that for one second he would spare the people who are, you know, the bullies who came and tried to take their lunch money.
Not at all. So. There's still that streak of vengeance that runs deep within him. And you could see it in part when the Septon was telling the story about how he cut the boy's throat and the mother was screaming for mercy.
He'd been there.
A little bit to the backstory between the Mountain and the Hound and their relationship.
When the Hound asks, if the gods are real, why haven't they punished me? And the Septon looks straight at his face and it's like, they have. That reminded me of the Mountain, like what his brother had done to him and the fact that he's burned and wounded and all this stuff in his life. That stood out to me as being...
Yeah, that was an interesting question from the Hound. I would have felt like we all could have looked back on his life and assumed that he'd been punished for something, right? I mean, does he just walk around feeling hashtag blessed 24/7? I mean, that's not... I just thought that was interesting that he assumes he should have received greater punishment, or that dying is the greatest punishment that he could receive. So I thought that was an interesting attitude. But yeah, it's going to be... My major question is, where is he going to go next? Like, what... Who... And what's he going to be like? Is... I think we've been saying he still has glimmers of the Hound as we know and love him. But how has he been changed based on the time that he spent with these people? And I think that that's hard to answer that question until we actually see him come face to face with whether it's the Brotherhood or whoever those people are, or if he heads back to where the action is.
Well, he picks up an axe, as you mentioned, and if you remember, the axe was the weapon that he was using outside of the Red Wedding when he hits Arya in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if there was any symbolism there, perhaps.
And he had something in his flask or water bottle, and that made me just
well. He managed to sort of peace out while an entire village of people were slaughtered, and he only came at like
that
the very
was the only thing that
just chopping wood
was the a little suspect last, to me.
Yeah, the very last scream of the very last woman managed to catch his ear. Thank God. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe he suffers from blackouts. Maybe he, you know, still on the recovery
in the
process.
Zone.
Like.
I'm not sure about that.
He was owning some wood.
Yep.
I do feel like we're dancing around talking about Arya a little bit.
Well, let's go for it, guys. I mean, this is.
Are you able to compose yourself? I feel like the last few minutes of that episode gave you a little bit of trouble.
Well, so Micah, you're like, where's the rest of the episode? 8 more minutes. And I'm thinking, I've had enough of this episode. I don't need to watch Arya wander through the streets clutching her stomach for 8 more minutes. Arya got stabbed multiple times in the abdomen. And now she's stumbling through the streets of Braavos with blood dripping everywhere.
I have a theory.
You have a theory, and I like your theory.
Well,
so why don't
this
you tell
is actually a theory on
is
top of
the Is this a different theory?
Is this the one you shared with us earlier today that made me lose my mind a little?
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to go there first. In terms of Arya wandering through the streets, dripping blood from her guts, I think Lady Crane is going to save her.
Yeah, I was hoping she would go. She's sort of the
only friend Arya has guaranteed in Braavos right now. So I was
hoping
for...
And she owes it to her almost. Does Lady Crane know that Arya saved her life? I don't know.
I think she does.
Yeah, I think that was pretty clear.
Yeah, so I would say that if she's going to be saved by anybody, yeah, I like that a lot, that it's going to be Lady Crane. I was hoping that we would see her and at least get like some sort of glimpse of recognition before leaving her alone for a week.
You know you're going to get that cliffhanger, Hannah.
No, I hate it.
But speaking of Arya and that particular scene, I thought it was very reminiscent. We don't get it in the show. We get it in the books. The talk of how her mother, Lady Catelyn, was dumped into the river. Mm. And then, of course, we know that even though she does not survive, that she is revived by the Brotherhood, by Thoros of Myr, as Lady Stoneheart. And a lot of speculation has been made about Lady Stoneheart. I know you guys talked about it last week on the show. And I saw this really great theory that came out of an interview that Yahoo did with both Maisie Williams and Sophie Turner. It was Two Truths and a Lie. And I think people know generally how that game works. And so where it all netted out was the theory that Arya is going to steal Catelyn's face from the House of Black and White and return to Westeros as Catelyn Stark and just go on a Frey killing spree.
And I love this.
I love this theory. It's one of the best theories that I've heard in a long time, and I hope it comes true.
What do you think about the theory now that you've seen this episode? Because we were discussing this morning that the Waif, and this could still be up for debate, has some sort of Frey connection. That's been something that's been speculated a little bit, which may not have part in this theory anymore, but do you still feel like this is a strong contender after seeing tonight's episode?
That the Waif could help her in some way?
Or just that you still think that she could take Catelyn's face?
I do still think she could. Well, she didn't have Needle on her, so I wouldn't be surprised if she did attempt something along those lines. I think she's still going to pay the Waif back. Whether or not the Waif has a connection to Walder Frey, I just thought it was very suspect the way that she reacted when Arya mentioned that name. There was that moment where she turned around and then she said, "Is that all you have on your list?"
Right.
It could have been nothing, mm-hmm. or it could have been something, I guess, time will tell. But we also know there's the scene with Arya running and jumping over a wall.
How does she do that with her guts? She's essentially been eviscerated.
So I guess she's okay.
Takes great abdominal strength to leap forward like that. You know,
Why would you run if you didn't steal something?
I love that.
Unless you're running for your life.
I love everything about this. I think that no matter who heals her, and I hope it's Lady Crane, I expected her to walk into the sort of the residence of the troop at the end of this episode, but clearly it'll happen next week. I have a feeling that she will find a way to recover, and I love, based on the theory you shared, the idea that she'll make off, but not without paying a visit to the House of Black and White for one reason or two or another. I think, though, based on this attack that happened tonight from the Waif and she was disguised as an old woman, I think it really is meant to illustrate and point out that Arya has and still does have a lot to learn. Arya should have been on her guard the way that she was when she blew the fire out last week. She should have been, anyone who comes within 2 feet of her to 6 feet of her, she should assume at this point, based on what she knows, she should assume they're out to get her. And this old woman completely managed, granted she didn't see her coming, but managed to be that close to her and say something like, "Oh, sweet girl." And she turned around, didn't flinch, but turned around right into the woman who bladed her, shivved her, whatever you want to call it. It was very Ollie-like, sadly. But, this was too easy for the Waif. That was what upset me the most was, the Waif totally owned her right then and there.
Yeah, I think that did. It surprised me that she hasn't been a little bit more on her guard. She seems a little cocky about it, but I'm going to let it slide because it's Arya Stark.
Well, yeah. And what a badass getaway. She knew that she could escape through jumping into the water and not resurfacing in her vision.
Confirm the kill, though, Waif. She should know better.
Yeah.
Confirm the kill. I love that you said that. My question, too, is why the gut? Because, is it ultimately there are a lot quicker ways to die? So maybe it was that a gut wound is one of the slowest and most painful ways to die. I'm pretty sure that was even said on this show, but medically it also is in real life. And so is it that the Waif wanted to cause the most pain possible to Arya? I think that's very likely. But at the same time, not just confirm the kill, but unless you're saving the face because you want to wear it someday, just stab her in the face or slit her throat or do any number of things that guarantee she won't get away. You have the element of surprise. If what you really want is Arya dead, don't dick around with it. But the stabs to the gut and
she did stab her a couple times though. And then she fell into the water. So
she jumped into the water. I mean, it was not there was a high railing that Arya had to vault over to get away. And I think it was all because the Waif did not. I mean, she went for the gut, but that was not perhaps the most direct,
it
best
reminded
way.
Me of Talisa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that horrific scene at the Red Wedding.
I spent most of this episode wondering if Sansa is now pregnant with Ramsay's kid. I didn't even begin to think of that Arya. Like, you know, I mean, I understand what you're saying. It's exactly like
what caused
Lady
you
Talisa.
To think that?
What?
The way that Lyanna Mormont looked at Sansa and seemed to suggest, we'll see, didn't she say something about, Sansa's claiming, you know, that she's a Stark, and she's like, is she a Bolton? All of this, really. And I think, talking with people beforehand, everybody was like, well, what if Sansa's pregnant? Is that why she's dishonest to Jon? And we see more of that this episode too. I mean, her sending a letter without Jon's wishes, like, why is she doing all this? And, you know, to what extent does she know? So Sansa kind of creeped me out a lot in this episode. I worried about her.
I just wanted to say before we move on to Sansa that the reason, Micah, why I like your theory so much about Arya, Lady Stoneheart, is because I think we've had a big question mark about how Arya fits into the whole story. I think we've talked about, now that she's leaving the House of Black and White, like, what's she going to do and where's she going to go and what's her purpose, her greater purpose? Because she's just been kind of out of the picture for a long time. And so I like that this idea of her taking on this Lady Stoneheart type role ties her back into the main storyline.
Ties her back into the fray.
Ties her back into the fray a little bit.
That shot of her viewing the Titan. In this episode, she's standing looking out at it. She books passage on a ship. Awesome, awesome, awesome. But her looking at the Titan from the other side, you know, from the other direction where she's going to be leaving Braavos. I thought that was an excellent and well-orchestrated shot, well-conceived, too.
It was almost nostalgic.
It is time almost for her to return. And you know, there are many returns. It's a return to her roots. It's also a return to herself. And I like the idea that she'll possibly take Catelyn's face with her if it resides in the House of Black and White. It's possible that the Waif and her will have a showdown and the Waif will wear the face to trip her up. Imagine if the Waif comes at Arya as her mom, as Catelyn.
That's
how cool would that be?
Insane.
That is pretty creepy.
I just think that's like you're saying, Eric, it's time for her to leave. I think she's learned what she's... I mean, well, obviously she has to leave. She has no choice. Or she's going to get killed. But I don't know. There's nothing else that has sparked my interest in what Arya is going to do next other than this. I think... I don't know if you guys have thought of any other things that Arya is going to do when she gets back to Westeros other than start to tick off her list. But to me, that just seems a little...
That was another piece of the Two Truths, One Lie game, was that she would take care of three people on her list. So wonder if that's a truth or a lie. But I agree. I think her storyline has gotten to a point where why send her to Braavos and have her go through this training in the House of Black and White only to have her die on the streets of Braavos? I don't think that is really a good use of her character. But we all know that in this world, stranger things have happened, and to just kill off a character like that could happen. It's not something that's out of the realm of possibility, but if in fact she is going back to Westeros, I think she does need a purpose. She does need a way to fit into everything that is going on. And given the fact that Walder Frey was in the last episode, given the fact that we have all of these families coming together at River Run, the Freys, the Lannisters, the Tullys, and everything that's going on in the North, I think that she could fill in a role where she starts to exact revenge for what happened to her family. It's not just going to be Sansa anymore, fighting her battles up in the North. I think something needs to be done to the Freys for what they did at the Red Wedding.
It makes a lot of sense. And, you know, as much as I want to talk about Sansa next, I'd also like just to talk about the Freys since you went there. And The river. I mean, we just got a lot of the Riverlands this episode, and I think that for as much as is going on in the North, we're reminded every episode about the threat from the dead, and you know the recruiting in this episode of Jon and Ser Davos and Sansa was an amazing part of the episode that we'll also talk about. But for me, there's a lot more going on in the Riverlands. Like, the show is slowly with the Frey. appearance last week and the characters heading there. And I know we've even talked about this before, but they're clearly setting up a pretty large plot point. Several characters who we wouldn't even expect are traveling to the Riverlands, or the ones that come back to life and are in the Riverlands, like the Hound, are all there. And it's clear that something that the show is making a big effort to revive all the plot lines that take place there, because it's going to pay off.
Right. And bringing back characters that we haven't seen for seasons.
Edmure,
who was in last episode but hadn't been for quite some time. The Blackfish makes a return. Bronn is back. All these characters that we've come to know and love or hate in some capacity are finally all coming together for what appears to be
a showdown,
a battle for Riverrun.
Have you seen the did you see the preview? Did you catch the preview of next week after the, we pretty much, and I don't want to spoil any, but we get the Brienne and Jaime reunion that we've been thinking about. Get hype for everyone. Yeah.
I'm excited about what's going to go down in the Riverlands. I love Blackfish is just like not having it. Like they're coming, the Freys are coming at him with Edmure, like, we're going to chop his head off or we're going to hang him or whatever. And he's like, all right. And then Jaime comes up and is like, we're going to starve you out or we're going to fight you. And he's like, okay. Like, I was born in this castle. I'm going to die in this castle. So like, good
as
luck, I guess.
As long as I am standing, the war is not over. What a guy.
Yeah, he's just not impressed by anything that's going on, which I think is so cool.
And not by Jaime. He made
not
that
by
very
Jaime
clear.
At all. Yeah.
The Jaime Blackfish stuff in this episode. Like, who could expect that this was going to happen? And Jaime tried. And Jaime did a great job running up to the Freys and showing them, basically handing them their asses, and pointing out everything that they were doing wrong. But still, he did not leave even the smallest mark on the Blackfish.
And it's funny because Cersei, before Jaime left, was like basically implied, at least in my opinion, of let's take back that castle because it's ours and it won't be that hard. Let's just do it real quick. At least that's the implication that I felt like she was saying. And now here we are trying to take it back real quick and it's not happening.
We have enough provisions to last for 2 years. Do you have 2 years? I mean,
but we do not. We don't have 2 years as the audience, so we don't have time.
And we know
for that.
Winter is coming, right? We got that sense from the camp scene with Jon and Davos and the wildlings when they said that Stannis had stayed there. And, you know, he said the snow just as much defeated Stannis as the Boltons did. So eventually that weather is going to make its way towards Riverrun. And you can imagine if the Blackfish and his soldiers have enough provision for 2 years, that Lannister army and Frey army and any others that join them is not going to be able to wait it out for that long a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, then again, they need those provisions to last winter too. So they may seek to resolve the war in some way that does not involve waiting 2 years.
Let's hope so. Yeah, I'm excited. I think that this, especially this episode, was very much of setting up the pieces, especially in the Riverlands. Like, let's pull it together and get ready for whatever this battle is going to look like. So I'm really excited for next episode. I know it's kind of early to start getting excited for next week, but I just think that we've set the pieces here.
And
with,
we're on episode 7.
I know.
Out of 10, we have three.
Only three more to go.
Left.
So it was cool to kind of watch them set this up and get in place before, like you said, we're going to see Brienne in the next episode. Let's fight.
I thought this episode was very much a Game of Thrones episode at its core, meaning not as much of the magical element to it, but more of the strategic element to it, the actual game being played. There's the mention of the White Walkers by Davos, but overall, did you get that sense? I mean, whether you were talking about what was happening in the North with Jon and Davos and Sansa trying to form their alliance, or what was happening in the Riverlands, what was happening out in Volantis with the Greyjoys, talking about wanting to ally themselves with Daenerys.
They stole Euron's plan.
Yeah.
And then King's Landing, you know, as saying? Well. I mean, yeah, King's Landing as well, like with Olenna and with Margaery.
100%.
Agree. Like, there's a lot of politicking going on in this episode and kind of...
None of it was boring. There were no boring small council scenes. There were no incompetent Tommens about...
No farting.
No, you know, it really... Hallelujah. It felt... It was so compelling from start to finish. I never got a chance to talk about the last episode,
but and the reason why I'm bringing up this idea of this episode being more of a Thrones type of episode is because I really didn't like the ending to last week's episode. I thought, here's Dany up on our pulpit again. This time it happens to be Drogon. And it just, how many times is she going to do this? How many times is she going to, you know, get the rally cry going? You know, everybody cheering, and I, forgive me if you guys talked about this, but I just thought it's like the 100th time that they've done this, and it's like the 100th time that at the end of an episode, oh, by the way, we need to get Dany in there, so at like 55 minutes in, we're going to throw it out to Meereen or throw it out to Vyas Dothrak, and you're going to get like this really awesome scene from like a CGI standpoint, but it just feels like we've seen it over and over and over again.
I think that something that's comforting to me, especially seeing the Greyjoys in Essos, in Volantis, was it? For me, you know, the Long Bridge, Horing and Portheon.
Okay, but, maybe you didn't agree with what I said.
I think that for me, what's comforting is that it'll clearly be so different in just a few episodes' time that we won't be saying we've seen something before. You know, regarding your point on last week's episode, sure, I can see that. But in a couple episodes from now, mm-hmm. we won't be saying that because these characters who've never interacted before will be thrust into each other's graces. And, you know, essentially, we won't even be able to recognize through placement of these characters in these new unique locations, resurrections of certain ones and new powers that others have found. You know, it will be so different. And if this season has shown us anything, it's that it'll be so different quite soon.
It's just a very slow burn, I think, with her, for obvious reasons, mm-hmm. and you know, the lack of connection between Westeros and in this case, let's say Meereen. We got it when Tyrion and Varys show up, but now you're right. The fact that you could be bringing another set of characters into the fold in Yara and Theon, I think, it could set up a really great strategic alliance that could give Dany the ships that she needs in order to sail back to King's Landing and start to try and reclaim what she believes to be rightfully hers.
Well, and now the thing with Yara and Theon here, you know, she says, we've got fast ships. We shouldn't really worry about our brother. I was rewatching the end, the Dany scene from last week's episode. And she, at one point, Dany asks, I believe it's just Dario, how many ships they would need to get all of their men across the sea. And he does the math and says, oh, at least 1,000, probably more. And going back, I didn't have a chance to look it up, but I think 1,000 is the exact number that Euron said they should build on the Iron Islands. Maybe I'm wrong. Did he say 100 ships? Do you guys remember?
Well, either way, there's no trees on the Iron Island, so I don't know how they're going to build any ships.
But I mean, so my theory with Yara and Theon is that they'll treat with Dany and tell her more ships are on the way, knowing full well that their brother's coming to get Dany, and maybe they'll somehow, you know, court her favor, so that Euron can be betrayed, or you know, she can just take his ships because they don't quite have enough ships in their little fleet that they got away with to do the work themselves. They still need, it's still a deficit of, I assume, several hundred ships.
If I've learned anything, though, from the season of Game of Thrones, and especially this episode, is I'm not going to worry too much about how people get from point A to point B.
Yeah, for real.
Because I feel like it's been, I think that you're, like, if we're going to talk logistics, I think that we could run into a lot of problems.
Sorry, was I boring you?
No, you're not boring me at all. But what I'm saying is, like, these are all legitimate questions that I would have worried about before. But now that we've got this episode where we've got, like, Sansa and Jon and Davos are in every major house of the North,
yeah.
Or we've had Littlefinger flying across the country to arrive where he needs to be.
I'm not worried about it. That's continuity error. That's an actual error.
Or the Greyjoys. I mean, they got to Essos very, very quickly.
Right. So if one day Dany just shows up in Westeros because she just showed up in Westeros, I'm just going to have to be like, all right, I guess we'll read about it in the books. So.
But that was a great scene between brother and sister. And I feel for Theon, how could you not in that situation? You could see the frustration on his face being in a brothel, given his condition. And just the way that his sister was able to bring him back, you know, for how long did Ramsay torture him? How long did Ramsay beat him into thinking that he was Reek? And in those few moments, you could see, you know, the title of this episode was The Broken Man, and there's probably no person in this series that describes more than Theon Reek. And just the way that he was able to be brought back and the job that his sister did, knowing that Theon has returned. I mean, there were glimpses of it throughout the last, let's say, season or so, but that look that he gave her, you could tell that he's going to do everything that he can to support her moving forward.
I certainly hope so. And I love how basically direct she was with him. I mean, she explained that she needed him, and not just this pansy ass represent, like this former, you know, obviously very wounded shell of a man that he was before. I don't know the exact quote. I'm sure it's in my notes somewhere, but that you know, she tells him to go slit his wrists if he's not willing to be the brother that she once had, because that's who she needs right now. And it was very matter of fact, and it was very straightforward. And I don't think it left no questions. And that's just how the Ironborn are. And I'm admiring them for, you know, staying true to their identity. But Yara was so good in this episode and said, exactly what he needed to hear for like the 10th time.
Yeah. I mean,
Well,
she says, I'll never hurt you. And she says that, you escaped. I've got your back. I mean, she's supporting Theon, and he's making these comments about, well, if we're going to get justice, and I should be hanging in Winterfell for everything I've done. And she's like, look, you and me, we're going to figure this out. Like, we're going to fight for our family, and that's all that matters now. But I need you, exactly like you're saying. I need the real Theon.
Yeah. Okay. I found the quote. Not this rat shit pretender. There we go. I knew I had to find the exact quote.
Yeah, that's good.
That was good.
I like that quote.
I really like it. But I agree. I thought that there was an incredible episode between the two of them, and it just brought back so many. The look on his face brought back so many memories of him being tortured, and I'm sure that being in a situation like that has got to be incredibly uncomfortable and triggering for him. And so
I just remember how forward he was with Roz early on, and even when he first met Yara after being away from the Iron Islands so long, and was handsy with her. And in the books, I think he's handsy with the ship's daughter, the ship captain's daughter, on the way to Pyke. You know, and that's just, that was who he was.
And then with his sister once he arrives on the island.
Yeah. And with the sister.
I honestly think that, you know, she says, I know you've had some bad years. That really gets to him.
And I know that Theon, we've had a rough relationship with Theon throughout the entirety of this series, but I'm excited for him to get back to who he is. I mean, maybe we haven't always liked him and he hasn't always made great decisions, but I want that spark back in him, you know, and I think that it's going to be interesting to see him and Yara find Dany and get some of that fire back in him, as I'm hoping.
I wonder what Tyrion would have to say about Yara and Theon showing up and trying to court Dany. I wonder what advice he would give her. Obviously, they're good with ships, but I don't know that it's clear that they can be trusted. I mean, essentially, I think everyone who knows anything about the Seven Kingdoms knows that the Iron Men are in it for themselves. And I think Tyrion's council would be pretty much, you know, as much as that. Like, the Iron Born. And this is coming strictly from a show viewing potential at this point, because I haven't even gotten to the King's Moot in the books. You know, for me, they seem like the most leaderless group, or the most likely to have a mutiny, essentially. Like, you know, if Yara and Theon's shit goes south, the men could abandon, because and they wouldn't even be necessarily betraying their oaths, because they're fueled by who is the strongest, right? That's the whole reason the King's Moot was even allowed to happen, and you have so many people vying for the Salt Throne, because they just, you know, they view power and taking what's theirs, and there's a sense of pride that's tied to the community, but it's actually also just about taking what you want. You know, we do not sow this, that, the other thing. And so I think that if things were to go south for Yara and Theon, unfortunately, you know, they couldn't necessarily count on their men. And I think Tyrion would be smart enough to know that as well.
And we wanted to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, Blue Apron is bringing you the best. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious, home-cooked meals.
New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team and are not repeated within a year. So in the month of June, the meals that are available include spicy Korean rice cakes with snow peas and pea shoots, sweet chili ponzu, catfish, and green beans with coconut ginger rice, and New England-style salmon rolls with roasted potatoes and chives.
Sounds really good.
Yeah, sounds incredible.
It sounds delicious.
And healthy, by the way.
It's also very flexible. You can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. You can choose delivery options to fit your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Also, and finally, it's easy. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card, pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less.
And I would just say that that last part is huge. You know, just working all the time. I know all of us do here. The fact that you can get it delivered right to you and make it in 40 minutes or less without too much effort, and it's good and nutritious, that says a lot.
It's a game changer.
Yeah.
So you can check out this week's menu and get two free meals with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/owns. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/owns.
Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
I think that them showing up in Meereen shouldn't take away from the fact that Dany could still run into Euron prior to arriving back there, right? There's this sense that just because they're going to look for Daenerys, that they're going to find her, and we all know that Meereen is void of her right now. She's not there.
That's fair.
So I wouldn't be surprised if the Crow's Eye finds his way to Dany before Dany is able to meet up with Theon and Yara. And look, Tyrion had a scene, albeit very brief, right, with Theon all the way back in season one when they're talking about Roz. And I just think that Tyrion, to your point, is too smart. He knows what Theon did. He knows what he was responsible for. And I think that his reputation will precede him in that sense. Though, look, what do they say? Like, war makes strange bedfellows. So this show proves that to be true time and time and time again. So
that's a very good point.
We will see how all of that ends up playing itself out.
I mean, Theon's own men betrayed him at Winterfell because they didn't have confidence in his leadership abilities. So, yeah, I don't feel too good about this Greyjoy expansion that's happening here. But it obviously makes for great television because I remain enthralled.
And in the books, the King's Moot is this whole big to do, and it's not just Euron and you know, Yara. Theon isn't even there. You have Varian, who is another brother of Balon Greyjoy's, who's vying for it. And you know, you think about these chairs, right? The Seastone chair, the Iron Throne, all these different chairs. Like, what do they really mean at the end of the day? And I think that was Davos's point in his conversation to Lyanna Mormont, which I don't know where they find their child actors. But
another good
she
one.
She was incredible. Gold.
She was badass.
Yeah. Loved her.
Her and Shireen, the two of them.
You know, I honestly think that that's why Davos had the upper hand here. I mean, Davos is obviously 100%. The world's greatest mediator, but he's interacted with a girl her age before and had a warm relationship. And I couldn't help but feel that, like, not that it was against her will, but Lyanna Mormont genuinely liked Davos, and his approach to her, seeming to know that she was about to ask her advisor, for instance, what was House Davos, you know, and calling her and understanding exactly what her thoughts and motivations were and telling her so, was the key to winning those wonderful 62
men.
I have to say, I saw a tweet here, which I just loved on Facebook from Josh Williams, who said, "My own goes to Lyanna for living up to the name." And then hashtag J plus L equals 62. So
that's interesting.
I like that. I like that nice little twist.
I do think that this is where Davos comes in handy, though. And we see Sansa's mistrust of him, which is a whole nother topic. But I think that, you know, you look at Sansa and Jon, they haven't had the same type of experience that Davos has. And sure, he worked for Stannis, and Stannis didn't end up, quote unquote, winning. But how many men has Davos negotiated with? And how many times has he been in a situation like this where he's able to kind of relate to whoever he's standing in front of? And so I think that his knowledge and his understanding, his empathy, exactly, that's a good word, is vital for someone like Sansa and Jon, who are just standing there like, because we're Starks.
Because we're Starks, right? Call the banners. See how well that worked with Lord Glover. Mm-hmm. See how well that worked with House Glover when Sansa pulled that card. It already wasn't going well. But when she did that, I mean, she just got shut right out. So you have Davos, right? And his empathy. Think about how many characters, how many pirates he turned to. And pirates are the complete exact example of someone being, you know, in it for yourselves or in it for glory, but not really having an alliance. And how many men did he convince through his various means to support Stannis and go to the ends of the earth, literally? In doing so. So Davos is the perfect companion. And I know Sansa doesn't trust him. She questions Jon, oh, you know, this is your primary advisor now. And on one hand, I'm thinking damn straight he is. On the other hand, I'm thinking, you know, for all that we've seen Davos do in this chapter, and it's been amazing since episode one, you know, he never really did grieve for Stannis. And I am thinking that something's a little off about that. What do you guys think?
I think he was more concerned about Shireen at the end of the day, and he didn't like the relationship between Melisandre and Stannis.
Yeah.
I think
the Shireen thing
moment
is the key there.
We don't know how much he truly grieved, because remember when Melisandre returned at the end of last season, you could see the look in his eyes. Really, the emotion came when he was asking about Shireen. He developed such a bond, such a relationship with her, and really it was almost as if she was his daughter. And I mean, remember, he's lost all of his sons in the show.
Yeah.
It's not the case in the books, but in the show he has, and he's a father at the end of the day. I thought that is what allowed him to really endear himself to Lyanna, and I thought he was even going to mention the fact that he understood the position that she was in because he had lost everything much like she had. And it was just that connection, that having spent so much time with Shireen, he was able to connect with Lyanna. As you guys mentioned, as she was having the conversation with Jon, oh, well, your last name is still Snow. You're a bastard. Sansa, well, are you a Lannister? Are you a Bolton? What are you exactly? You're not a Stark. And so to have Davos there as the mediator, harken back to when he was at the Iron Bank with Stannis, and he was able to, after
show them
Stannis
the hand.
Failed miserably, right?
He showed them his hand.
he was able to get them to give Stannis the money that was needed in order for them to.
I mean, ultimately,
do.
Ultimately, but they waltz into Stannis' former encampment. You know, today, and there's no reaction. And I'm wondering, did he just was he able to just completely write Stannis off? And I'm not talking about whether you think Stannis alive or dead, because I have different feelings than everybody else about that. But I'm talking about Davos's ability to keep a clear head. He's immediately breaking up fights that are taking place. It doesn't even give him pause. The situation doesn't give him pause. Interacting with Lyanna Mormont was amazing, but we haven't seen him in any way, shape, or form really, truly decide what kind of man he's going to be.
I mean, he saw Jon come back to life, and he believes Stannis is dead. So I don't know really what sort of choice. I think he's doing what he needs to do to survive. Like, I think that there's no time to mourn this loss of this man that, you know, we don't know what his feelings were towards him at the end of Stannis' life anyway, just with, like Micah was saying, with everything that happened with Shireen. And so I just don't know what else we would want him to do necessarily.
I mean, I'd never rather have anyone else in your corner than Davos. We've said this before with Stannis. I mean, Davos as a point of view character in the books makes Stannis bearable because he loves him so. But then, I mean, Davos' loyalty to the men he gets behind are complete and, you know, surefire, and you can't get in the middle of them. And seeing him at the Wildling camp too, just sort of being there and making sure that things don't go south and adjusting, you know, correctly if they do. It just, Davos to me is really, and he's found the man that he's going to get behind till the end again. Mm-hmm. It's funny to see him. We're talking about new beginnings. We're talking about returns. And this was a really this was a return to form for Davos too in this episode. In that he was able to successfully, it's not even about giving good counsel, but he was able to win these 62 men, and damn it if they're not worth 10 of the mainlanders
and
per person.
Well, 620,
right. Let's be real here. But I think that Davos, the thing that's so great about him is that he gets it. He understands, mm-hmm. and it's like he was saying to Lady Mormont when he was standing in front of her, is that the real threat is between the living and the dead. And this is our war for all of us to be fighting. And I think that he is able to have a clear head, and I think that he's able to reason with people. And Jon and Sansa are so emotionally invested, and not to say that Davos isn't, but this is their family name, and this is their house and their livelihood. And so I just think that he's able to really remind everyone constantly that, you know, if we're not live together, die alone, if we're not all band together, then we're going to get wiped out by the White Walkers.
Well, and it was just so funny that Lyanna Mormont, again, you know, getting back to it, was saying, you know, are you a Bolton? Are you a Lannister? You're not a Stark. You're a Snow. You're not a Stark. And then Davos steps up and says, you know, I'm not any of those houses. In fact, you've never heard of my house. It's fairly new. You know, he succeeds by being just so genuine, so humble, and he's even less related to their cause. And I think it was able to convince him, but, convince her to the cause of the living versus the dead. I'm also thinking, though, at this point, and look, this might be a crazy scenario, but at this point, they should just keep a bag full of, severed hands of the dead that are still writhing around. Wasn't that a thing at one point in, book one? You know, they sent a piece of a white to King's Landing, and I think the only reason it wasn't still shocking and terrifying was that it actually decomposed on the way to the point where it couldn't be animated still. But they really need to start showing people. I feel like more than telling, oh, the living and the dead. And John mentioned Hardhome, and I'm pretty sure Lyanna hadn't looked at a map to know where that is. So, you know, these words and these names and these places, but they're in a real position to have proof anymore. This isn't the same place where we were 5 years ago or five seasons ago, where a deserter from the Night's Watch can come down with stories of White Walkers and get assassinated because clearly they can't be true. We all know, you know, because we've seen and things that we've done, that these things exist, and it stuns me that John wouldn't see the need, or these characters wouldn't see the need, to really manufacture some sort of hard evidence and proof more than their words. Because ultimately, as shown in this episode, words will only get you so far. And I felt like House Glover really needed to see a reanimated corpse before they were going to pledge their swords to Stark again.
I think that's all great, but where are they going to get the evidence? That's the real question.
I mean, they're not going to go
north of the Wall and just hope that a White Walker or a White finds their way to them and then hack them down and then bring them to all these different houses of the North.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
What?
This is something they could have done at Hardhome, or, you know, get one and bring it.
They were running for their lives, so I don't think that they were necessarily worried about
it. And that's where my speculation comes. Okay, maybe it's crazy thought, but...
No, it's not crazy thought. I understand what you're saying. I think evidence always helps the case, but I think you had a realist in Davos, right? Remember, it's Davos who reads the letter and gives it to Stannis. That he's the whole reason why they weren't dismissive of what was being asked by the Night's Watch. Mm. It's Davos who gets Stannis and his army to go and sail north to, you know, help them fight the wildlings and eventually, you know, go to battle against the Boltons. But then he is realist in the sense that, okay, Stannis is gone now, but there's a much greater fight that we need to fight here. And Hannah just mentioned this earlier, but maybe it's easier to convince a 9 or 10 year old girl that these are real things. In fact, I mean, you mentioned Hardhome, but John also mentions the Fist of the First Men where Gior was killed. And so I just think that, you know, you're able to convince the wildlings, but they've seen it. They know it's real. Able to convince the Mormonts. It's a small group. Like you said, when you get to the Glovers, they don't want anything to do with it. They feel like they've already taken their losses. They feel like, you know, Rob led them astray. And
that was so interesting, wasn't that? I think it's cool to see. It's really cool to see the effect of
past actions.
What Rob's campaign did was on these other houses that we weren't even thinking about. I mean, what was he saying? That where was King Rob when the Ironborn took his castle and when his family was put into jail? And
I mean, I'm pretty sure he was dead, but still, I mean, he said taking up with a foreign whore and getting those around him killed.
Yeah, so it's
that
interesting.
That's exactly right, yeah.
And I think that it was very interesting to see them standing in front of the Glover home and Sansa's response with believing that just because they have the Stark name means that they should follow her and follow them, and how she kind of has this idea of loyalty and values that values heritage. But, you know, I think that the only way that, I mean, I think that a house like that is past listening to something that the Starks are going to say at this point, whether it's the threat in the North or whether it's rally against, so we can take back our home.
I mean, he says to them, I received you on the honor of your father, right? Ned Stark is a guy who can move mountains. And, you know, we wept when we heard of his death. You know, these were real powerful things to say to these guys when they arrived, you know, to John, to Sansa, to Davos. And I believe them. But at the same time, Lord Glover knows that he's not going to be penalized, that they don't have the men. And I think there's some kind of threat in there too, like, we'll just come for you too if you refuse us afterwards. But this is a man who knows that there will be no immediate consequences from turning these men away. He's not about to attack the Boltons, whom he said helped secure their castle and get it back from the Ironborn to begin with. And he knows that there's no downside to saying no at this point.
And John has an army of wildlings.
If Ned Stark were still around, yeah, but I mean, he can shake his, he can turn his nose up at this idea of the wildlings. Oh, you know, they're not like, I dared not believe it was true that you've taken up with wildlings. Like, fuck you, dude. They're people. Like, seriously, like, we have a real army.
That's easy for us
to say. We have a real army. This is a guy who for generations has been fighting the wildlings for centuries, I'm sure. The ones who make it over the wall and rape and pillage in the gift. And the northern houses are all stick to death of wildlings. I get it. It's a tough sell. But ultimately, I mean, John is doing this. Nobody went to strike John dead right then and there, right? I've talked about this before, how anybody in the Seven Kingdoms can get away with killing him because he's technically a deserter of the wall, right? Not everybody's going to believe that he came back to life right, and actually died protecting the realm the way he was supposed to. So there's some semblance of belief there. They treat with him. They understand. They, you know, listen to his ploy, but then deny it. And I'm just like, dude, where do you come from? But House Glover's just rebuilding. That's all they're doing right now. They're just rebuilding. They're not taking part. They're trying to ignore the pressing threat and pressing danger. And
well, they had just reclaimed Deepwood Mott, right?
They need to be, they need to be shown that there is no safe haven for them, not even now.
Yeah, and I guess it was maybe naive of me, but I just assumed that it would be fairly easy for them to sweep up some more northern support. So I was surprised. I guess, I mean, hindsight, it seems like, of course, it was going to be a little bit more difficult, but I had so much faith in our new dream team that I thought that I just assumed that they would be able to roll up and get a better response from people.
Did they? I think they talked to two or three houses off screen. The only reason I think that is because when they're walking into Stannis's camp, the dialogue, they go through the people they've got, and it's not just the Mormonts. So I don't know if they were if they did manage to get like one or two other houses, in between.
But not significant enough. I mean, that
certainly
that was
not
the sense that I got from in the Manderleys were also mentioned, but that was during the conversation. Was it with the Glovers when they mentioned the Manderleys and they hadn't heard anything back yet? But
I think so.
We alluded to this earlier. The letter that Sansa sends, which is, you know, the last of those scenes. In the episode, we're assuming that she's sending a letter, I would think, to Littlefinger, right?
Mm-hmm. My thought was that she was sending it to Littlefinger. I think that she is trying to stall a little bit. I don't know why she just won't come out and tell Jon that she's got this army in the Vale that can come sweep through and help them. I don't know why she just won't come out with it. I don't know if it's just because she doesn't trust Davos and so she doesn't want him to find out, or if she's trying to like be in it for herself, which I don't think is the answer, but I think it's interesting how she's trying to stall John a little bit instead of just coming out and saying, hey, because he's ready to go, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the impression that I got, is he's ready to fight, and she's like, well, we can maybe muster up some more support, and I don't understand why she just won't say, hey, we've got all these men that we desperately need.
John doesn't really have enough information to mistrust Littlefinger, so far as I'm aware, except the knowledge of what he did to Sansa at Winterfell, you know, which I'm sure she conveyed to him at this point. But, you know, it might just be crazy enough to work where, and Davos doesn't, so far as I can recall, have any reason not to trust Littlefinger, or hasn't interacted with him directly. So, you know, if Littlefinger were to show up, if the men of the Vale were to show up, would they turn them away? I doubt it. You know, they just don't know enough to be suspicious of that, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vale,
they could
after
just
all,
be owing a debt, right? I mean,
right.
Certainly there's a connection between the Vale and Winterfell, just given
absolutely
the fact of you know, Lysa and Jon Arryn and Ned and Jon's, you know, sort of relationship, if you will, having grown up, you know, sort of under the tutelage of Jon Arryn, both him and Robert Baratheon. So there's definitely that connection. And of course, Robin is Sansa's cousin. It would make sense. And Robin himself, even a few episodes ago, said that he wanted to help Sansa. But, you know, as is always the case with Littlefinger, you wonder now what the price is going to be. He offered the assistance early on, and now having passed on it, what is the price going to be for Sansa? Should he indeed come to her rescue?
And I worry the price for Sansa as well with her relationship with Jon. I mean, I worry so much that there's going to be a rift there or that something's going to happen. I just feel like I don't understand what her motive is in this sense. Right? I mean, it's just a little confusing as why she is keeping such a major thing.
The longer she continues down the path of deceit, the more we really worry. Like, and wonder crazy things about her, like, is she pregnant? Which I mentioned earlier, but, you know, and I have no reason to suspect that other than she's kind of acting a little strange, and I'm wondering if there aren't more concerns that we're unaware of, such as that. So, I'm just not sure at all.
But she clearly came to John for help. I mean, I know right. there weren't many options in terms of where she could go, right. but
right.
I agree. I think it is a little bit odd, that relationship. So we'll have to keep an eye on that and continue to explore it further as time goes on. But you know, it's also a cause for concern too. I mean, you never know which side Littlefinger is going to play, assuming it all works to his advantage, and it could all be a trap for them. Letting the Vale know where they are, what they're up to, if they choose to ally themselves with the Boltons for some reason, you never know. I mean, you never know what Littlefinger is up to, but I foresee this battle taking place and the Vale showing up to sort of save the day for John and company. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But
lots of little pieces that need to fall together in just the right way.
The 2,000 wildlings, like, they're not just cannon fodder. Like, these are the men who have fought the armies of the dead time and time again. And I loved that scene with the wildlings. I loved everything about it. And these are seasoned men who, you know, have no obligation necessarily to fight, although some would argue they do, but they agree to it. And it's actually a decision. And that line, we're not clever like you Southerners when we say something, we'll do it. Like, they will be with John at Winterfell no matter what. And I love that. And also, how good did it feel? This might have been like the third episode, if not the second, the third, without Ramsay in it, the third episode of this season, like in a row without Ramsay.
Oh, and I do not miss
the fact that he's not there. Nobody.
I felt
will
so
die.
Damn good about it. I'm like, this episode is great. I'm on
no
cloud
one will
nine.
Be eaten by dogs or unceremoniously stabbed.
Yeah, he was kind of there
the
with
absence.
Theon, though. He was kind of there with Theon.
Yeah,
I mean, if you think about
his mark, I that was a little close for comfort for me. But I felt very relieved again that we did not. I love the abs. I love that actor, but I also like his absence a whole heck of a lot.
Well, maybe next episode. Only time will tell. But one character that we did get to see, which is always a treat to watch on screen, her younger version may have appeared in Lyanna Mormont, but the Queen of Thorns, she pulls no punches.
I love her. She had. These scenes with her were so incredible. I really loved, I mean, just the look on her face when we're back in King's Landing and she's having these conversations with Marjorie, which Marjorie was wearing her crown, which I thought she must be very happy about to have that on her head. But her face when she's talking to Marjorie about wanting to send her away to Highgarden, and she's just like, what are you doing? And I loved that moment when Marjorie folds up that piece of paper with the rose on it and gives it to her and kind of to assure her of, you need to leave, you need to get out of here, and everything's going to be okay. I got it under control.
It was so perfect. It was so simple. The rose, you know.
I love the fact that she's sitting there at the table writing when Cersei walks in, and she just continues to focus on what she's very much Tywin. She reminds me a lot of Tywin. She's going about her business, but yet she can still keep track of the conversation, slip in those little one-liners, and she just goes at Cersei. Not only that, but Frankenmountain is standing 10 feet away from her,
she
if
doesn't
not
care.
Closer, and she doesn't give a shit.
Can we talk about how that scene ended? Because Cersei was pretty much trembling with anger, I felt. That was when the scene finally cuts away, I would have been not surprised at all had we seen, if that scene had continued like another 30 seconds, Cersei telling the Mountain, Frankenmountain, Robert Strong, whoever we're going to call him, to strangle her to death just so Cersei could watch. Because I thought at that moment that she would have gotten pleasure out of nothing else, such as then seeing Lady Olenna killed in front of her. I really thought that was going to happen. Right then and there. Cersei, because it was such a successful takedown of Cersei and everything she stands for.
She does it all the time. It's not like this was a one-time thing. I mean, this is probably the fifth time or more that she's done this to Cersei in her presence, to her face, with no reservation at all.
This felt conclusive. This felt somehow like an ending to me.
Well,
it could be.
you hear Olenna say, Lady Olenna say, you have no support. And so I think that this is different for Cersei this time, because Cersei realizes how alone she is. I mean, she, there's nobody backing her up. And Lady Olenna kind of goes through the lists of Jaime's gone. She doesn't have her family behind her side. Like, the all of King's Landing hates her. And so she's got no one to fall back onto except for the Mountain, which, I mean, if you're going to have anybody to fall back onto.
Yeah, it's a pretty good whatever to have. I don't know what to classify him as. But yeah, I mean, think about it. Kevin, her uncle, is not loyal to her, or so it seems, in any way. Tommen has drifted off to the High Sparrow, and
she calls a shoeless zealot in this episode.
That was my favorite. Well,
and she takes responsibility. I mean, she owns up to the fact that it's her fault that they've been able to really seize control of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And
gosh,
the Queen of Thorns says, yeah, you're responsible for that and a whole lot more.
I wonder if you're the worst person I've ever met. And my age, it's hard to remember.
I was literally going to quote it at the same time.
It was such a good scene. And I really wonder what's up Marjorie's sleeves. Nice fringed sleeves now.
Yeah, she's clearly up to something.
So something I was thinking about, and this could just be all over the place, but I was just thinking about Marjorie being called out for not giving Tommen an heir yet, or not joining him in the marriage bed, however the High Sparrow says that. And I'm wondering if that's part of her strategy, if she just, her getting pregnant or her bearing child for Tommen means that she's then connected to their family. And so if she's able to just kind of get out of this with just her, I definitely think that Tommen is going to be, and we talked about this a little bit last week without you, Micah, but I think that Tommen's going to end up being collateral damage almost in Marjorie's ploy for power, because you see that crown on her head, and in my mind, she's got everything she's ever wanted. And she's said that before, that she's in it to win it. She's in it to become the queen, whatever that means. And so whatever steps it's going to take to get there, I definitely think that Tommen is going to fall by the wayside, unfortunately for him.
Certainly possible.
Something that wasn't said by Cersei, it was said to her leading up to it, you know, when Lady Olenna is suggesting that Cersei leave King's Landing. And that's a great suggestion, but we know it's not going to happen. And she says, I will not leave my son. But what occurred to me as that scene was happening, I was watching it for the first time, I was like, you know, she's really a glutton for punishment. She's condemning herself to witness her son's death. Say that Tommen is marked for dead, you know, that Marjorie betrays him, makes out some kind of deal where she can rule as just queen without a king of Westeros. You know, 100 things could happen, but Cersei's going to be there to witness it. And it's all because this prophecy said she would, right? She's not going to leave. I think leaving King's Landing would actually protect him in a way if we set 100% in store by the prophecy, because she's supposed to be witnessing his death. But that's the only thing that's holding her there, I think. Is this notion that she could do something to prevent his death by being there. But
well,
she'd
do anything for her children. I mean, that's what she said. The only truth that she knows is loving her children. And so I think that there's no other options for her.
I agree. I think that Tommen ultimately will be collateral damage, as you put it. It's unfortunate, but you know, it's always the case with prophecies, right? Is that once it's foretold, you wonder how much of it is circumstance or how much is it the people knowing what is supposed to happen. They take the steps to try to avoid it. And it's those steps that ultimately lead them in the direction of it becoming fulfilled. And for Tommen, it doesn't seem like things are going to work out too well for him in the next few episodes, but we'll see. Marjorie is definitely a power player. I don't see her, you know, going down so easily. And for Cersei, I think that she's going to have to find a way to get herself out, whether it's of King's Landing or just of the situation that she's in. I mean, she should have taken the advice that Ned gave her all the way back in season one, prior to Robert Baratheon's death, which was take your kids and go.
Yeah. If only, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe Bran can go back and tell change us that.
Mess with time. Yeah, maybe he can.
I prefer he doesn't. Yeah, but that would be cool.
So this was an episode that was jam-packed with returns from the Hound to Bronn to Blackfish. And like I said, it really was one of my favorite episodes so far this season. Eric, you said it was your favorite.
Yeah,
I just love that it was at its core. And I mentioned this earlier, really what I think about when I think about Game of Thrones. And, you know, there was this little bit of magic on the surface, not too much of it, which we know it's going to continuously play a larger role moving forward. But just all the different strategic elements with the North, with the Riverlands, even across the Narrow Sea. So I'm sure we'll jump into more of this later on in the week when we get to our Owns episode. But for now, I think we need to give our Owns of this episode because that's what we do here. And there were plenty of opportunities. I mean, if somebody doesn't give at least one to Lyanna Mormont, we're just going to stop the show right now.
Well, you know, I have four owns I can't decide between.
Four. Yeah, but four. I have two that I'm
not
really
gonna
like.
I'm not going to give them all, but if anybody has Lyanna Mormont, you should jump now.
Go for it. It's all you.
It wasn't me. Something. I don't have one of the ones I don't have.
I wasn't getting my own to her either.
I don't want Micah to get angry with us here, but I have so many to choose from, and although she was amazing, they're not.
Let's just say she owned the episode, and then we can give our own individual ones.
She owned the episode over the Hound?
Yeah, I mean, all right, anyway, let's just...
Okay.
Who's going first? Where is this going to net out?
Eric,
I'm not
gonna
give all four because that's just pretty sure that breaks all the rules we've ever set. all right, here's my four part own. Ian McShane, Septon, violence is a disease. You don't cure a disease by spreading it to other people. What a great line. To which Rory McCann, the Hound, replies, you don't by dying either. You know what? It's just gonna be a two parter. My real own goes to the Blackfish for measuring Jaime Lannister. Jaime in his brand new, you know, great looking armor shows up to save the day, to show the Freys how it's done, and the Blackfish owns him 10 ways to Sunday and asks him specifically, do you wish to resume your captivity? I mean, this is such a badass,
such a good moment.
Gentleman. I mean, what the hell are you doing if you're not loving every minute of everything that comes out of the Blackfish's mouth? So own the Blackfish.
It's a good own. That's a good own. I'll give my next. I am going to give my own to Lady Olenna for her line of calling the High Sparrow a shoeless zealot, because I just like can't stop thinking about how he never wears shoes. And so I'm happy that she made a great joke about that.
She
so,
made note of that. Yeah.
Yep.
She
own was to Lady Olenna.
On fire. Do you remember what she said to the Olella lady? You're not in your sanctuary now. My men will stroll in here and bash you until I tell them to stop. If I tell them to stop.
Yeah, she's on a roll.
She's on fire.
Yeah, I forgot. I actually during the episode tweeted out about that particular scene, said something along the lines of between the High Sparrow talking with Margaery about needing to, you know, cater to Tommen's needs, and Septon Onella just being like this really creepy hovering individual is like a bad episode of Sister Act.
Yeah, I mean, no lines this episode that I can recall. She had excellent presence.
Yes. And speaking of presence, my own for this episode goes to 1-1, who was just chilling there during the Wildlings meeting with Jon and Davos and Sansa, and they basically just look to him for a decision, and he says, Snow, and mic drops. Mm. And, you know, I have to say, I'm impressed. He's learning the common tongue.
Yeah.
You know, he's on the side of the Wildlings and on the side of Jon. So,
well, it's like, hey, what is that saying? The Eskimos have like 100 words for snow. You know, it's like they do see enough of it up there. But yeah, I'm with you. He totally understood what was going on.
And what I really liked about that was you see 1-1 as he's like as I said, mic drops and then walks off. Mm-hmm. And then it immediately shifts to the scene with Cersei walking in the mountain behind her. And you can see the stark contrast between how tall 1-1 is. Like, you always think the mountain is being like this hulking badass motherfucker. But in the scene before it, you see 1-1 and you realize he's actually like, you know, what, 100 times bigger than him?
Yeah, 1-1 could take him down in 2 seconds. Yeah.
I thought he was going to step on John for a second there. Yeah. But
so good owns. I like these. And I know that we got many, many, many that were sent in to us during the episode and after the episode on Twitter. The Twitter feed was buzzing throughout tonight's episode.
Love it.
But please feel free to continue to send in your owns. We will get to them on Wednesday's episode. And there are a number of ways that you can do that.
Yes. First and foremost, over on Twitter, and we do live tweet these episodes. Micah killed it another night. Micah killed it again. Tweet us after or during the episode at Game of Owns, or go to twitter.com/Game of Owns to check out our feed, all our retweets, and our funny live tweets during the show. That's over on Twitter. On Facebook, we do a call for owns after the episode airs. You can share those with us scrolling upon our Facebook wall, facebook.com/gameofowns. And also email, contact@gameofowns.com is our email address. Don't wear it out. And you can send all your longer format letters of owns, ownage, or appreciation to us there. And nobody appreciates us the way we appreciate you, the listeners, for being and taking part every week in this very excellent social experiment.
It's a social experiment.
You're
like
secretly
that.
All being tested, yes.
That's not creepy at all.
We've revealed it.
We should mention that over on Watchers, before we record our episode in the midweek, we ask a couple discussion questions for people to participate and give their feedback and answers that help shape the discussion that we have on our midweek episode. So head over to Watchers on the Wall sometime early this week if you want to participate. We have so much incredible feedback every week about the different discussion questions that are yet to be determined that we put up there. So if you want to participate in more than just sending in your own, so you can also join in the conversation there and kind of dive deeper into moments that we loved from the episode.
Absolutely. Like you said, there's always a lot of great feedback and interesting feedback. And, you know, while something like Twitter is good for the instant feedback, I love kind of reading through all the comments that people make over on Watchers. They're always very well thought through.
Mm-hmm. Something happened over the past week, you guys, which is that we got a new month of the year. It is June. It is another month for our Patreon supporters over on patreon.com/goo to reap the rewards and benefits of being a supporter of our show, namely the Squadcast, Squad of Ice and Fire, which we do. We record briefly before our episodes, before our Game of Bones episodes. So when the content is extremely fresh and you can find all sorts of shenanigans yet to come as well for our upcoming public appearances together with each other. Looking very, very forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun. More about that later. And really just Game of Owns has a Patreon, and you should check out the reward tiers and see if it's something that you can get behind. We have our small council, whom we love and adore. We read their owns every week on the show, which you will have heard. And really, it's just a great community and a great, great crew, great squad.
And it's also Hannah's favorite podcast.
It's also my favorite podcast. That's saying something.
Not this one.
Mm-hmm. Not the one I'm on.
And one other way that you can interact with the show, as many of you have been doing this season, is over on iTunes. Just leave us a rate and review. As Eric mentioned, is the month of June, so nothing less than 5 stars is acceptable. And I figured I'd read a few here. We got one from DJ Chris Baker, who says, "I drink and I know things." He says, "I drink and I know things. And the one thing I know for certain is that Game of Owns is the king of Game of Thrones podcast. Long may they reign." That might be a...
I'm going to put that on a t-shirt.
You should put that on a t-shirt.
You should put that on a t-shirt.
That's pretty darn...
I'm kind of concerned about reigning in Westeros. It doesn't work out for most people.
True. True.
There's also Piaf Princess, who says, "It is known. This has become one of my favorite Game of Thrones recap podcasts. Intelligent discussion and speculation, added humor with a nice mix of book and show knowledge. podcasters even have pleasant sounding voices. An added bonus.
Highly recommend. You know they're talking about you, Micah.
It is known.
Yeah, it's definitely that's Micah's comment. But thank you.
We velvety blanket you.
Nosage 3 says, wow. Fantastic dialogue, thoughts, and opinions. Great people, great show. Better than the other Game of Thrones podcasts out there. Highly recommend. And finally, from Boy Has No Name, says, this is the best Game of Thrones podcast you will listen to, whether it is the banter, the theories, the predictions, or the interviews, Hodor. They bring it every week. Sometime I look forward to hearing their views about the episode more than watching the episodes themselves. Then I go back and watch the show again and it's mind-blowing what they will open your eyes to. Must listen, must subscribe.
That's sounds so like a awesome. Good show, guys. I'm going to subscribe to it.
So we do appreciate all these reviews that you give the show.
Very much so.
Especially during the season, as you can see, there are a lot of people who find out that we exist, and one way for them to find out that we exist is by you leaving your feedback. It helps us jump up the charts in the iTunes store. So we thank you very much, of course, for reviewing the show, but appreciate you listening and sending in your feedback every single week during the season.
That's it.
Guys, that does it. Until later on in the week, Zach will be back. Can't wait to hear his thoughts on The Hound. Coming back. So he's coming back and the Hound is coming back. So you know it's going to be a good episode. There's still probably so much more to talk about. The three questions, Hannah, that you mentioned always provide a lot more insight into things that we discuss immediately following the episode. So I can't wait.
Me neither. I can't even begin to predict what the next three total episodes will have.
But we're going to try.
A Lannister always pays.
Don't say it. Don't fucking say it.